Is this thing live? There we go. I think we're on YouTube here. And there's Facebook. And there we are on the website. All right. I believe we are live. So, hello, everybody. And let me know if you can hear me and if we're coming in loud and clear. How's everyone's week been? Yeah, comment. Let me know you're watching. I'm just trying to make sure we're good to go on here. Yeah. So, thanks for tuning in. I see a few people on Facebook. Might be frozen here. Oh, Norman says we're watching on YouTube. Sweet. So, yeah, thanks for tuning in to another, or this is week three in our walk through the book of Genesis. Oh, I see Kevin is watching on Facebook. Lori says good evening. Hey, Lori. Yeah, so as you hop on, just let me know you're watching. It's always fun to see who's actually tuning in. If you don't comment, then I can't necessarily see who all is watching. So I'm always curious to see who's tuning in. So, like I said, this is week three of us going through the book of Genesis. Just like I always kind of give some instructions at the beginning, as we go through, like we're going to finish up chapter one and then get into the first few verses of chapter two tonight. But as we go through, if you have questions or you want to make a comment or you need me to repeat something or clarify something, please type it in the chat. Let me know. And I will do my best to, answer that. David and Ann are watching. Hey, David and Ann, thanks for tuning in. And yeah, that just makes it a little bit more interactive and fun as we go through this. So last week, we looked at the first 5.5 days of creation. I was hoping to get through the first 6 days, but just for sake of time, we stopped after the first half of day six. So we looked at 5.5 days of creation and just kind of trying to understand, how did God create everything? And I'm hoping that you saw some of the beauty and the wonder of this passage, because Genesis 1 is constructed quite beautifully, like the pattern of it, I guess. And so one of my things that I've been trying to do all along these last couple of weeks is compare the Genesis narrative to other ancient cultures' narratives of, their creation account. Because what's fascinating is that all of these other ancient cultures had creation narratives, basically stories or myths or legends about how the world came into existence, why we're here, what is the point of life, where did everything come from, all of these worldview questions that come up. And so all the, Babylon and Egypt and Assyria, they all had creation narratives. But what's amazing is the Genesis narrative kind of stands apart from all those other ones, because there's all the other ones have similarities, and there is some similarities between those and the Genesis account, but it kind of stands apart as very distinct in some very important ways. So, So day one, I'll just give you a quick recap of the first 5.5 days. I see Emily and Peter are watching and Frank is watching. Yeah, I think the website's not working right now. So, hopefully people that try to watch on the website can just come over. I think we should all agree that Pastor Andrew is the best pastor. Who is that on Trying to see who is that on YouTube. Okay, yeah, sure. The screen name is Tenjula, but I don't know who that is. I think we should all agree that Pastor Inge is the best pastor. That's funny. You don't have to agree that. So day one, we saw God creating, right? He separates, God creates light, and then he separates the light from the darkness. And so we talked about how essentially God creates time on the first day, right? Because he's separating a period of light from a period of darkness. He calls it day and night. And then he says there's evening and there's morning the first day. And so God's creating time. He's setting up this function of time in the universe. Day two, if you remember, God separates the waters, right? He takes some of the water and he puts it above, and he creates this expanse, which he calls heaven, which is essentially the sky. And so God takes some of the waters, puts it above this expanse. He separates the water from the water. And so really what God's doing is he's creating the atmosphere. He's creating the sky. He's getting the earth ready to be inhabited. So he creates space, essentially. Day three, then, if you remember, God, he gathers some of the waters up and he separates the water from the land. And so he creates dry land, and then vegetation. So I hope you remember from last week, like these first 3 days, it's like God is setting up functions and he's creating different spaces that are then going to be filled and inhabited in days 4, 5, and 6. So days 1 through 3 and days 4, 5, 6 kind of are meant to, they go together, right? Day 1 corresponds with day 4, and day 2 corresponds with day 5, and day 3 corresponds with day 6. And it's this beautiful pattern and structure that exists here. So, like I said, days 1, 2, and 3, it's like God is setting up a habitable planet. He creates time and space and land and food to eat, and now he's going to go and fill those spaces. So then day 4, God, and this is the parallel, right? Day 1, God creates light, and he separates light and darkness. And then day 4, he creates the sun and the moon and the stars, right? That's the thing that fills day 1. And so he creates these lights in the sky, sun, moon, and stars, to serve as signs for the passing of time and to separate night from day and to illuminate the earth. And so we talked a little bit about how, you know, in other ancient mythologies and creation narratives, the sun and moon and stars were seen as gods. And here, God is making them. They're not eternal. They're made and they're created to serve humanity, not the other way around. And so there's some distinction there. And then on day 5, God basically fills the water and the sky with animals. He creates birds and sea creatures. So again, like think about it. Here on day 2, he separates the waters. And here on day 5, God fills the sky and the water. And so it's all the types of birds, it's all the types of sea creatures, all of that. And then day 6, which we looked at the first half, God creates animals, and then tonight we're going to look at how, that's terrible spelling, not Haman's, humans. God creates humans basically to fill the land that he created on day 3. And so we talked about last week that God created, right, there's 3 types of animals, right? He talks about according to their kinds. Livestock, which would include, you know, cows and sheep and horses and goats and all those kind of livestock animals. And then creeping things, and then beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And then he saw that it was good. And that's where we kind of stopped, right? Those first 5.5 days of creation. Oh, Kevin says, no new clock, right? I don't know if you can see it, but this is my bird statue. I thought since we're talking about like creation and God creating animals and stuff, I don't know if you can see it, but I got this from Zambia. It's a little bird crane statue instead of a clock. It's kind of in the shadows over there, so there you go. No new clock. And hi, Suzanne, watching from the island. Glad you tuned in. That's great. And Tanjula on YouTube is Bruce's son. That's who the mystery guy is. That's awesome. So that was the first 5.5 days of creation. Tonight we want to look at the second half of day six, the creation of mankind, male and female human beings. And then we want to look at the first couple of verses of chapter two, which talks about the seventh day when God rested. And we want to get into, well, what does that mean? Why does God rest? What does that have to do with anything? So here's what's interesting about the creation of the human race and why it's so important. Actually, all of Genesis 2, pretty much, is devoted to an expanded description of the creation of human beings, which we're going to look at next week. Some people have said, well, maybe Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are two different creation accounts, but I actually don't think so. I think Genesis 1 gives us this big overview, including at the end, the creation of human beings. And then Genesis 2, it's like it zooms in to an expanded description of how God created human beings. But really, humanity is the crowning achievement of God's creation. And all of God's creation was moving towards God creating people, men and women, male and female, in his image. And so you'll see, like, already everything is kind of moving towards that, right? In the first 3 days, God is setting up this habitable world with, you know, an atmosphere and time and food and weather. And then he creates, right, lights in the sky to illuminate the earth and to use as the passing of the seasons and to separate light from darkness. And then he creates all these animals, which we're going to get to, right? Human beings are meant to have dominion over all of these animals. So everything in creation is moving towards this climax on day six, essentially. And God's crowning achievement. So let's read Genesis 1, 26 to 31, and then we'll kind of unpack that, and then we'll look at the seventh day. So jumping right in, this is right after God creates the animals, and God saw that it was good. Verse 26 that says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created a male and female. He created them, and God blessed them. And God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth.' And God said, 'Behold, I have given you every plant-yielding seed that's on the face of all the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food.' And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day." So here we have, right, the creation of human beings. And there's a lot in this, and there's so many, you know, ways we could go as we talk about this. And so please, if you have questions that come up from those you know, six or seven verses, please comment and let me know. But we'll start in verse 6. You'll notice that there's a few interesting words that are used by God, right? Verse 26, it says, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So you'll notice that there's plurality used in verse 26. And we haven't seen that in Genesis 1 so far, right? It's been kind of as far as in our translation, here's what's interesting, right? We look at in the English translation, let us make man in our image after our likeness, but in the Hebrew, the name for God that is used for 21 of the first 25 verses is Elohim, which is actually a plural noun in Hebrew. Elohim is a plural noun. So already in the Hebrew language, the name that is used for God, 21 in the, used 21 out of the 25 verses, is already a plural noun. But when we get to our, right, English translations in verse 26, this is the first time where you kind of go, well, that's interesting. Who is God talking to, right? Cassie asked, are there any other places in the Bible where God refers to us or our? Yes, there is. If you flip a little bit to the Tower of Babel, God speaks in the plural as well. So that, here we go, verse 7. So God looks at the Tower of Babel that they're building. He says this, and he's talking to himself, right? The Lord said, behold, they're one people. They all have one language. This is the only the beginning of what they'll do. Nothing that they will propose to do will be impossible for them. Verse 7, come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them over all the face of the earth. So there's another example in the Tower of Babel where God says, let us go down and confuse their language. So you have to ask, well, what is the plural about? And so there's debate, actually, over what could this plurality mean, right? And so there's six real possibilities of what does it mean that God says, let us make man in our image after our likeness. The first one would be, well, us refers to other gods. That could be a possibility, right? If you believe in pantheism, that God, Elohim, right? God the creator is just one of many gods. Well, then maybe, right? Maybe God's saying to the other gods, hey, let us make man in our image. Now, if you were an ancient Babylonian or an Egyptian or an Assyrian, that would be no problem because they were all pantheists. They all believed in multiple gods. So that's probably how they would have interpreted, oh, okay, well, there's plural here. So there's obviously multiple gods. But we know, right, you get to Deuteronomy 6, and this is what God says to Israel. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, right? So there's only one God, and there's spots in Isaiah, and there's spots in the Psalms that talk about, no, there, you know, God says, I am God, there is no other. So it can't be that God is speaking to other gods, right? That doesn't fit the biblical narrative. Secondly, some have said, well, maybe it's referring to the heavenly court. So maybe God is speaking to angelic hosts or other divine beings. Because, I mean, you get to some other places and it talks about other divine beings. It talks about kind of like a heavenly court that God has, essentially. And so whether these are angels or other kind of divine creatures, some have said, well, maybe God's just speaking to them. Now, that very well could be, but the problem is, like, God is saying that he's going to make man, so mankind, in our image, after our likeness. And the problem with that is you and I, as human beings, we aren't created in the likeness of angels or other divine beings. There's a problem there, right? Because we're created in the image of God. So I don't know if I could say, well, yeah, God's just talking to other divine beings, because we're not created in those images, right? Some have said, well, maybe God is speaking to the earth. Because if you get to chapter 2, you'll know that God, like in the expanded story of how God creates human beings, we're actually made from the dust of the ground. So some have said, well, maybe God's saying, hey, let us, meaning, hey, you and me, earth, let's make man in our image. So I'm going to mold man out of some dust of the earth. And so maybe God's speaking to like the ground, the dirt. Fourthly, someone says, well, it's just a plural of majesty, right? The plural is just meant to pluralize the majesty of God and the majesty of what's going on. And so some have said, yeah, it's not really a plural. It's just meant for us to kind of be able to try and comprehend the majesty of it. Fifthly, some have said, well, maybe it's a plural of deliberation. So basically, it's maybe God speaking to himself, right? And so, you know, some of the examples were given. I don't know if you do this, but some people speak to themselves while they do things, right? And so I don't know if you've ever been driving. You're like, well, maybe we should go to the post office before we go home. Like, so I guess some people talk in the plural while they talk to themselves. I'd be interested. Does anyone watching do that? Do you just kind of have a running commentary as you do life? Maybe we should go and do that. So some have said maybe God's just talking to himself, right? And it's just a plural of deliberation. God is, you know, he's just like us, right? He talks to himself while he does stuff. So maybe it's not an actual plural. It's just the language that's used. And then sixthly, some have said God is speaking to the Spirit. And so maybe verse 26 is a Trinitarian understanding of God, but just using less direct terminology. So, right, if you think of the Trinity, and that's the theory that I would hold. I think verse 26, we're getting a hint, a clue of the plurality that exists within the Godhead. Now, here's what I would say. I would say it would be too far to say, yeah, Moses, he's writing this, and Moses was a Trinitarian monotheist, right? I don't think Moses is, we're not saying that Moses believed that, yes, God was three in one. I don't know if you could go that far, because I think when you talk about progressive revelation, as the Bible goes along, we are more and more is revealed about who God is. And so later on in Israel's history, there's talk about a Messiah and that he'll be divine. And then it kind of goes into Jesus. And then in the New Testament, the doctrine of the Trinity is expanded, and it's progressively revealed. So I don't think we can say Genesis 1:26, Moses, he was a Trinitarian. I think that'd be going too far. However, you and I, though, we read the Old Testament always in light of the New Testament, and you and I know that God exists as a Trinity, right? God is eternally Father and Spirit, right? He exists as a Trinity. He is one God who exists as three persons. He's not divided into three parts, right? It's not like God the Father is a third, God the Spirit is a third, and God the Son is a third. That's not what we're saying. God is one God has three persons. Each person is fully God, and there's only one God, right? The doctrine of the Trinity is one of those kind of, if you want to tie your brain into a knot. So you would ask, well, how much of God is the Father? Well, 100% of God is the Father. Well, how much of God is the Spirit? 100% of God is the Spirit. How much of God is the Son? 100% of God is the Son. Right? There's not 33% Father, 33% Son, 33% Spirit. No. There is one God who eternally exists as three persons, and each person is fully God, and yet there's only one God. So you can kind of wrap your mind around it, but that's part of the mystery of who God is. And so we know from the New Testament that Jesus was active in creation. So you flip to Colossians 1, right? Speaking of Jesus in verse 16, "For by him," Jesus, "all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him." So you get to Paul writing in Colossians, and he says, all things were created through Jesus. So Jesus was present at creation. All things were created through him. You get to John chapter 1 in the New Testament, and it says, "In the beginning was the Word," that's Jesus, "and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made." So you have two really clear texts in the New Testament that says, yeah, Jesus was present at creation. Everything was created through him, right? So then you read Genesis 1 through the grid of the New Testament. We should never read the Old Testament as if the New Testament never happened. No. The New Testament is the interpretive grid that we look back at the Old Testament with, and then we go, ah, okay, that's what that means. So, right, the ancient Israelites probably didn't fully understand as well as we do, maybe, because the New Testament hadn't been written yet. That revelation of who God was hadn't been given yet, and yet you and I, we've received that, right? And so we look back at verse 26 and we go, ah, okay, that makes sense. So really, the theological battle of the day, of Moses's day, the theological battle was not Trinitarianism, right? It's not as if Moses was battling with other theologians. No, God is three in one. The theological battle of Moses' day was one God who was uncreated, merciful, and sovereign versus multiple gods who were unpredictable and immoral. That was the battle of the day. Are there multiple gods or is there one God? And so we get a glimpse, right? This first glimpse, a hint at God existing as multiple gods. Persons. Suzanne says, by the second verse of Genesis, we have the Spirit hovering around. Yeah, that's a really good point. Even verse 1 gives us this glimpse. Okay, well, there seems to be multiple persons in the Godhead, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so you go, okay, well, interesting, right? There's God and there's God's Spirit. And then you get to verse 26, and God says, let us make mankind in our own image. So I think verse 26 is speaking of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Trinity active in creation. So God, we're told, creates mankind in his image. And then it says, after God's likeness. So we have two ways that we're created. We're created in God's image, and then it says we're created after God's likeness. Now, the Hebrew for the word image is tesalim, not Tesla, the car, Teslim. And then the Hebrew for likeness is demut. And Teslim is really interesting. It's a very interesting word. It actually speaks of carving. Teslim is basically the word for idol, which is really fascinating. Here's what's fascinating, because throughout the Bible, and you get to Exodus and you get to the law, and what were the Israelites commanded? Don't make any idols. And yet you have, I just find this so awesome, God creates human beings in his image, Teslim, which is the word for idol. So why don't we create idols of God? Well, God essentially is saying, well, I've already made idols of myself, images of myself. They are image bearers, same word used, right? So no, you don't need to make an idol to worship me. God says, no, don't do that. And God is saying, basically, I already have a bunch of images, right? I've created a whole bunch of images of myself. Now, these words, image and likeness, it means something similar, but not identical. So these words can be used as like parallel phrases, because some have said, okay, what does it mean that we're made in God's likeness? Image, right? And we'll get to it. Maybe that means our brains and our spirits and morality and all these types of things. But some have said likeness. Does that mean that like physically we look like God? And I don't think so. These words can be used as like parallel phrases. And basically, likeness would mean something similar but not identical. So how an ancient person would have heard, let us make man in our image after our likeness, it would have been something like this. Let us make man to be like us and to represent us. So it's about let us make man like us, right, in our image. But likeness is more the idea of they're going to actually, they will represent us. They'll be our representatives, essentially. A helpful example is in Genesis 5, verse 3, when a very similar phrase is used. It says this: when Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his own image, and named him Seth. So, super similar phrasing used. Adam had a son after his own likeness and in his own image. And so what do you kind of discern from that? Okay, well, Seth wasn't identical to Adam. Seth wasn't a carbon copy of Adam. He wasn't identical, but he was like him in many ways. Like, just like, my dad, right? If you were to write that in our day and age, right? When Rick Eby had lived 35 years or 30 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his own image and named him Andrew. Now, I look like my dad in a lot of ways, and I have a lot of mannerisms of my dad, but I'm not an identical copy, right? It just means that, yeah, I'm like him in a number of different ways. And then when I talk about, I have fathered a son, Oliver, and Oliver is like me in a lot of ways, right? He's in my likeness, he's after my image, but it doesn't mean that he's identical to me. That's really important, right? Because when it says that we're created in God's image and after his likeness, it doesn't mean that we are gods. It doesn't mean that we're little gods, right? There's in some of the Word of Faith theology and some of the charismatic, prosperity gospel type theology, there is a doctrine called the little gods doctrine. And they'll take this, right, the idea that we're made in God's image and after his likeness, and they'll say, well, we're like little gods, like small g, right? It's like, you have big G God, but we're made in his image and his likeness, so maybe we're like little g gods. That is not true. We are not little g gods, right? We are creatures, we're human beings. Yes, we're made in God's image and his likeness, but that doesn't mean that we're identical to him, right? It means God made us to be like him and to represent him on the earth. Hopefully that makes sense. We're going to unpack it a little bit more. But here again, here's the amazing difference between the Genesis account and every other creation narrative. In Egyptian or Mesopotamian society, the king might be called the image of God, right? But not the average canal digger or the mason or the blacksmith. No. There's no way that they are the image of God. Only the king is the image of God, right? And that's why you'll see often that, different kings and different dignitaries would claim that they were, God incarnate, basically, that they were, I am God. And so kings or high up people could claim, yeah, I'm in the image of God, but not ordinary people. But here's what's amazing about the Genesis narrative. In the Genesis narrative, setting up the worldview, right, for Israel, Genesis says, God creates mankind, and he says, all of humanity is made in his image. Not just kings, not just dignitaries, but all of humanity is in the image of God. And so that's a massive difference between the Genesis narrative and every other ancient creation narrative. You go, wow, okay, so human beings, all human beings are created with dignity, with value, with worth, with responsibility, right? And I think I shared from one of the other creation narratives that, the gods had created human beings because they were sick of doing all the hard work. So let's create some other, measly creatures that can do our work for us. That's not the sense that we get from the Genesis narrative. We have God lovingly creating human beings in his own image, and then he's going to bestow on them honor and dignity and responsibility in the world. So it's quite different. So really, all of creation functions in relationship to mankind, right? And then mankind serves the rest of creation as God's vice regents. It's like God is saying, okay, I'm setting you up as ambassadors. You're my representatives. You're my stewards of this world that I've made. And I want you to serve me by taking care of this whole world that I've made, essentially. So it's amazing that other Near Eastern accounts show creation was set up to serve the gods, and here we have the one true God setting up creation for the benefit of humanity. So the Genesis narrative really does, it kind of stands apart from the rest of these creation narratives. Now the question then is, what does it mean that human beings are made in God's image? Have you ever thought of that? What does that actually mean, that you and I, human beings, every human being that's ever been born, ever lived, has been an image bearer, made in God's image after his likeness, right? Made to be like God and to represent him, every human being. So what does that actually mean? And there's so many ideas, which I think there's a bit of truth in a lot of them, right? Some have said, well, maybe it's our conscience, the fact that we're like conscious beings, right? That we're actually self-aware, right? Animals are not, yeah, they're alive, but they're not self-conscious, right? Animals aren't morally aware. So maybe it has to do with that. Maybe it's our soul, right? The fact that you'll get to Genesis chapter 2 and it says that God actually breathes into the first human the breath of life, right? And so some have said, well, maybe the fact that we have a soul, a spirit, right? Maybe that is what makes us like God, because God is spirit. Maybe some have said, maybe it's the original righteousness that human beings had, like freedom from sin in the beginning, that we were like God in that way, that we were righteous and holy before the fall. Some have said, maybe it's our ability to reason, the fact that we can actually use our minds and reason and use creativity. Some have said maybe it's our emotions, the fact that we can feel love and empathy and pain and compassion and grace and mercy. Maybe it's our emotional capacity as human beings. One author I read said his opinion was being made in the image of God boils down to personhood. We are persons, right? Capable of relationships. Human beings are capable of fellowship and loving other people and communion with others. And we have an incredible ability to use language, right? And have conversations and share our thoughts and our attitudes. And so to a certain degree, I think there's truth in all of those answers, right? Because animals don't do this. Animals are conscious. But animals are not self-conscious. They're not morally aware creatures, right? I've used this example before, but right, we have a cat named Coco, and we've had this cat for, you know, 4 years or something like that. Great cat. Love him to death. but my cat doesn't sit outside at night looking up at the stars, wondering what his purpose in life is, right? Animals don't do that. Animals don't look up at the stars and go, you know, who am I in this big, vast universe? Animals don't do that. Animals are not self-aware, self-conscious, you know, individuals. They're animals, right? So, you know, a lion who hunts and kills a zebra in the savannah, we don't try that lion for murder. We don't go, you killed, right? No, animals are not held to moral standards because they are morally unaware, right? There's no morals in the animal kingdom. So I think there's some truth to all of those things, our conscience, our soul, our ability to reason, our emotions, our morality. I think all of those things are true about what sets humanity apart. In the comments, I would love other ideas that you've heard about what does it mean to be made in the image of God? What sets us apart? One guy I read said, well, even think about physically, right? We're upright and we can gaze up at God and all animals are kind of, and I'm like, well, I don't think it's actually anything to do with physicality or our physical bodies. That can't be what it means to be in the image of God. I think men and women being made in the image and likeness of God is what makes them utterly unique in all of creation. Notice that nothing else in creation is made in God's image. God still thinks that all of his creation is good, right? Every day so far, there was evening, there was morning, the first day, the second day, the third day, fourth day, fifth day. Every day he says God saw that it was good. Right? So far, every day, God has said, hey, this is good. And God loves the animals that he's created and the plants and the universe. He loves all of it. But nothing else in the universe is created in God's image. Not even angels. Nothing besides human beings, which is quite unbelievable, right? Now, here's what's really interesting. If you believe in an evolutionary worldview, that worldview of naturalism and biological evolutionary processes completely takes away the uniqueness of humanity and takes away being made in God's image and likeness, because if evolution is true, if that is how the world came into being over billions of years through natural selection, everything that exists today evolved from nothing. Right, over billions of years, it went from just atoms to ooze to insects to da-da-da-da-da. Then that means you as a human being, you have zero worth. right? If the evolutionary worldview is true, human beings have no worth, no value in the universe. You are no different than an animal or a fly or just primordial ooze that sits over there. You evolved from inanimate goop, so you are not special. That's the evolutionary worldview. And it's crass and it's hopeless and it's depressing, but that's what atheists and evolutionary biologists believe. Yeah, we're not special, right? They would never say that. But yeah, if you believe evolution, then as a human, you are not special in the universe. You are worth nothing, right? And then you can get into all sorts of things about morality and right and wrong, because if human beings are worth nothing, well, then who cares if I kill someone? I'm just freeing up resources for other people. And you can get into a whole bunch of interesting dialogue about morality and right and wrong, right? So even I'll give you an example, right? If natural selection is true and we're just nothings in the universe trying to survive and vie for resources, then when a tsunami wipes out 100,000 people, we should celebrate, right? When a tsunami wipes out 100,000 people, if you believe in an evolutionary worldview, you should applaud and say, yes, less people vying for my resources, right? But no one says that. When a disaster happens, we jump in to help. We search for survivors. If we really believe in evolution, we shouldn't try and revive anyone. We should just let them die, because it's less strain on our resources. So the evolutionary worldview breaks down when you begin to think logically and practically. No one lives like that, right? Suzanne says, I've always thought that part of our similarity to God lies in our ability to both create and appreciate works of art and to appreciate the beauty of creation. Yes, I agree with you. Again, right, you think about the difference between us and the animal kingdom. Animals don't sit down and enjoy a sunset because that's not in their ability. So, and yet we do, right? And we enjoy creation. And it actually, not only do we enjoy it, it like moves us, right? On a deep, profound level. So I agree, Suzanne. I think that's one aspect of it. So the evolutionary worldview removes the uniqueness of human beings created in the image of God. Now, if you're a Christian who believes in the evolutionary process, like maybe God used evolution to create everything, then you run into a whole mess of problems. And I'll give you an example. When I was a youth pastor in Maple Ridge, there was a guy in our youth group named Brogan, and he was a new believer. He had become a believer. I was part of the process of, you know, sharing the gospel with him. It was really exciting. But then as he kind of studied more about Christianity, he was a very scientific person. And I still remember this conversation. We had, it was in the Starbucks in Maple Ridge. And we sat down and he said, Andrew, I think, like I still, you know, believe in this, but I think that evolution is true. I think we evolved over billions of years from lesser life forms. Like we evolved, right? So we're from monkeys and apes and all those kind of things. And I believe God used that, right? He set the evolutionary process in motion. So I still believe God created everything. He just did it through evolution. And so you and I, we've evolved from monkeys and apes and all those kind of things. So the question I asked him, okay, Brogan, if you believe that, then when were human beings then created in God's image? Because if you believe in the evolutionary process, like when was that moment when now you're in the image of God and you have worth and dignity and value? And he thought about it for a moment and he said, well, I guess it would be right when we evolved from monkeys to humans, right when we kind of crossed that line, that's when God's image was, you know, given to us and we have value and worth. And so I hope you're seeing, like, it just completely breaks apart if you believe in an evolutionary worldview, because you have to go, you know, if you're a Christian and you believe that we've evolved from lesser beings, then human beings have no value. And how can we be made in God's image if we've just evolved from other species. So, and so it kind of breaks down a little bit. So I think being made in the image of God probably means a lot of things. One is our moral the moral aspect, that we are morally accountable. Human beings have an inner sense of right and wrong. We know the difference between right and wrong. Now, again, because of the fall, which we'll get to, that has become twisted. But I think inherently, human beings are born with a sense of right and wrong. We have morality, right? I think there are spiritual aspects of being made in God's image. We have immortal spirits, right? We have spirits that live forever. We can actually relate to God. We worship Him. We pray to God. I think there's mental aspects of being made in God's image. You and I as human beings can think logically and we can reason. We have complex abstract language. You and I have an awareness of the distant future. We've got creativity like Suzanne was talking about. I think there's relational aspects of being made in God's image like marriage, family, love, friendship, etc. So I think it can be and probably is all of those aspects. Right? That kind of separate us from the rest of God's creation. However, I think the text actually gives us a big clue to what it means to be created in God's image, right? God says, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness and let them have dominion." And then he says, "Over the fish, over the birds, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." I think a big part of us being made in God's image is the dominion that God has given us over His creation, right? We are created. Part of being made in God's likeness is that we're here to represent Him on the earth. So I think that's a massive part of what it means to be made in God's image. Notice that God doesn't say to the animals, "Hey, I want you to have dominion over this animal realm." Notice that, right? God says to the animals, "Be fruitful and multiply," but that's it. He doesn't say to a certain bird, "Hey, be fruitful, multiply, and have dominion over all the other birds." Or like he doesn't go to the livestock and say, "Hey, I want you to have dominion over all the other livestock." No, he says it to human beings alone. "I want you to go and have dominion over all my creation." So I think a massive part of being made in God's image is that we were created to represent Him by having dominion over His creation. Now, that doesn't mean that we dominate His creation, right? That doesn't mean that we just abuse His creation and do whatever we want. It means that we actually care for. And that's why you get to Genesis 2, which we'll get to next week, and God puts the man in the garden. And what is his job? Work it. Keep it. Like, care for it. And then what? Name the animals. I want you to have dominion. So I think when you and I exercise dominion over God's creation, I think you are imaging God the Creator. And so, it sounds silly, but we do this all the time. Right? So I think about my... like we're in the process of moving, so we don't really have a house, but next week we'll be in our new house. But last summer in our duplex, in our backyard, we got these flower boxes, but we decided we're going to grow some vegetables in them. And as I, as we're planting seeds, and as I am pulling weeds, and as I'm it sounds silly, as I'm taking care of my cat and dog and feeding them, and as I'm mowing my lawn, and as I'm pruning my choke cherry tree in my backyard, and as I'm pulling up the carrots and rinsing them, like that's us in a very real way having dominion over God's creation, right? I'm caring for it, and I'm keeping it, and I'm exercising the image of God in those things, right? So I think we do that, all of us do that in so many different ways. When I care for my kids, right? And that's one of the things that God commands the people to do. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. So basically have more, have babies, make more image bearers, right? And then have dominion. So that's one of the ways that we image God in our daily lives, by having dominion and taking care of his creation and the animals and the plants and the things on this earth. So yeah, like I said, God blesses the first human beings, right? Verse 27 is just a repeat. So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So here we go. We've got two genders, and I know this is because our crazy culture has decided to separate sex and gender, and that concept is actually a very new concept that kind of was birthed out of, oh man, we don't have time to get into this, but you know, the feminist movement and the sexual revolution and all these kind of things birthed this idea. Well, maybe sex and gender are different. Maybe you can be a male, but you're not actually a girl. And that is a new concept, right? Biblically speaking, when it says male and female, he created them. Biblically speaking, there are two genders, male and female. Gender is completely tied to your sex, your anatomy, right? XX or XY is your gender, essentially. But what's fascinating, and we're not going to go down that rabbit trail, because I would encourage you, we have a sermon series on our website called In His Image, where we unpacked all of that kind of stuff. And I don't want to get into that. I want to stay here. But it's fascinating because now it's not just men who are created in God's image, right? God says there's male and female created in his image. I think that's really interesting. If you want a full, complete picture of the image of God, you need males and females, which is fascinating, right? And so verse 27 is that kind of summary thing. So God, he created mankind in his own image. He created them, male and female. He created them. So God creates a male Adam, and he creates a female, both sharing the image of God. Not one more than the other, both created equal in dignity and worth and value, both image bearers, right? And then it says God blessed them. And God said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. So that's, you know, I want you to reproduce. I want you to have more kids. I want you to make more image bearers. And then he repeats himself, have dominion over everything, essentially, over every living thing that moves on the earth. And then God gives food to the humans and to the animals. It says that I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of the earth, every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I've given every green plant for food. So God gives humans every plant yielding seed, every tree with fruit, and God gives animals every green plant for food. So at no point in this original creation was anything allowed to take the life of another living being and consume it for food. Everyone was a vegetarian, including the animals, right, in the original creation. That's pretty fascinating. For me, I'm like, I don't know if I would have liked that. obviously, I would have, but I just love meat. But in the beginning, there was no, everyone was a vegetarian. There was no death. That's the whole point. The first death that we see is in Genesis 3, when God kills an animal to clothe Adam and Eve with its skin. That would have been the first death that Adam and Eve saw. Isn't that fascinating? So think about that, and I'm jumping ahead. But Adam and Eve have sinned, rebelled against God, and then they would have seen the first death They would have never seen death before that, because death is a result of the fall. So in this original creation, animals were vegetarians, human beings were vegetarians, there was no death, they all ate plants. And then in verse 31 it says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." So God doesn't say it was just good. He looks at everything he made and he says, it's very good. A whole universe now existed where nothing had existed only a week earlier. Isn't that fascinating? Yeah, I think that's so cool. Now, day seven, are there any questions about day six and the creation of human beings? If you want me to get into a little bit more, any thoughts or comments or questions about that? We're going to talk about day seven real quick. But any comments, any questions? I thought about, there's a lot of rabbit trails we could go down. And maybe we'll get into some of those rabbit trails later as we go. But I just wanted to kind of focus on the main thing. So any questions? If not, that's okay. But let me just give it a second. I think the website is working now. All right, if there's no questions, then we'll move on to day seven of creation. That's the first three verses of chapter two. So it says this, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." So day seven of this creation narrative, God creates everything in 6 days. On day seven, it says God rested from the work that he had done. Now, the question is, why does God rest? Right? The rest of day seven can be quite baffling to modern readers. Because we go, well, wait a second. Why does God spend day to rest? Right? And when I think of rest, like, is he in his hammock, taking a nap? Like why does that happen? Because even read Isaiah 40, verse 28. "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable." So Isaiah 40 says God never grows weary. So it's not as if he's tired from creating. Psalm 121 verse 4 says, "Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." So God doesn't need to rest. So why does he rest then? Now, here's where it helps to learn how ancient minds worked. In ancient minds, a deity rested in a temple and only in a temple. And that's what temples were built for. Temples like the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Assyrians and all that. They would build temples because that was where their gods rested. And so in the ancient world, rest is what resulted when a crisis had been taken care of and things had finally settled down. So if you think of the other creation narratives that exist, they all involve a conflict of some kind and then a battle, right? You have Marduk ripping the sea goddess in half and there's this big battle that happens. And then once the gods had taken care of that and the crisis was over, then the gods would be able to rest in their temples. So here we have a picture, I think, which is really amazing, of the whole universe being God's temple. And so there was no real conflict in the Genesis narrative. There was no battle that God had to do. He simply spoke and things came into being. But now God rests, and remember, in the ancient world, a god only rests in his temple, and we don't get to a temple being built for God until much, much later in the story. So here you have this picture of, okay, the entire universe is God's temple, and he's resting. Now, the Hebrew word for rest is significant. The Hebrew word for rest is sabbat, which I'm sure many of you have already figured out that's where we get the word Sabbath from. The Hebrew word for rest is sabbat, and it derives from the basic meaning of ceasing, basically like stopping something, ceasing. And so in the Hebrew language, ceasing, sabbat, would lead to a new state called nuha. Learning lots of cool Hebrew. And the noun of nuha is manuha. And in the Hebrew language, sabbat, ceasing, leads to this type of state. Nuha, manuha. And it means a position of safety and security, or stability. So the picture then, you have to kind of put this together, the picture then when God rests, when he sabbat on the seventh day, he's transitioning from his work of creating to the condition of stability, right? Nuha in the Hebrew language. It's the same terminology that is used in Exodus 20, verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. So when the Bible says that God sabbat on the seventh day, it doesn't mean that he kicked up his feet and he like took a nap and he had a nice cold drink and he just relaxed. It's a picture of God transitioning from his creating work, and it's like God's taking up his position in the control room, for lack of a better term, and now he's beginning his sustaining work of bringing safety, security, and stability to his creation. So that's what the ancient reader would have read. Sabbat is not God taking a snooze because he's tired. Sabbat is God transitioning from his work of creating to now his work of sustaining his creation. So even Psalm 132, verses 7 and 8, let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. Well, God doesn't need to go to a resting place to take a snooze, right? That means, God, go to your place where you sustain and provide safety, security, and stability. Psalm 132, later on, 13 and 14. For the Lord has chosen Zion. He's desired it for his dwelling place. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I've desired it. So in the ancient world, when a deity would rest in his temple, it meant that he was taking command. He was mounting to his throne. He was assuming his rightful place and his proper role. So really, you know, Genesis 2, the seventh day, is using the language of the ancient world, and here's God disengaging from setup tasks, so to speak, and now he's beginning regular operations. Day 8 and onward, God is in the control room running the cosmos, right? It's not like day 1 through 6, I created everything. Day 7, whew, I need to take a break. And then day 8, I'm going to start sustaining. No, day 7 is God transitioning into his work of sustaining the universe. Now also, here's what's interesting, we're told in Exodus chapter 20 that the rest of day 7 is our pattern as well. The Sabbath, the seventh day, is holy, right? It's set apart. And so we're supposed to, and there's a whole bunch of rules around the Sabbath in the Old Testament, right? They weren't supposed to work. They were supposed to actually take a day off and rest and enjoy God and enjoy his creation. The Sabbath was created for people, right? It's as if God is saying, hey, I've transitioned into safety, security, and stability. One day a week, you can just rest in that. You actually don't need to freak out about your wages and your food and how are we going to provide if I take a day off. God is saying, no, I've got it. This pattern is now you're going to just take a break once a week. So the Sabbath, the seventh day, is patterned after the seventh day of creation. Now, the question then is, do Christians today have to keep the Sabbath? That's a really interesting question. I would love to hear some comments. Do Christians today, are we bound to keep the Sabbath? Some would say, well, it's one of the Ten Commandments. And as Christians, we keep all the other Ten Commandments, or all the other Nine Commandments. So yes, we should keep the Sabbath. And so for many Christians, they take Sunday and they say, I will not do any work on Sunday. I had a conversation once with someone. I can't remember the exact detail, but it was like, you know, I gave him the scenario. What if, you know, someone called you on a Sunday and said, hey, you know, my tractor broke down while I was plowing my field. Can you come give me a hand to get it fixed? And this guy said, nope. I would say, nope, sorry, it's Sunday. I don't do any work on Sundays. I'll help you out on Monday. And I went, okay. So his view was, we are bound as Christians to keep the Sabbath every Sunday. No work is allowed. Now, here's what's interesting, though. Notice that Adam was not commanded to rest. Notice that. Right? Nowhere in this original first couple chapters of the Bible does God say, hey, I want to make sure, Adam, you need to take a day off once a week. Adam is never told to take a Sabbath. And the reason is, Adam's whole life was a Sabbath until the fall. Right? The Sabbath is actually only introduced the first time in Exodus chapter 16. So this is thousands of years later. Right? Exodus chapter 16:23, it says, this is when they are wandering in the desert and bread from heaven, right? God is feeding his people with miraculous bread from heaven. And it says this in verse 23, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside till be kept till the morning. So that's the first mention of human beings keeping the Sabbath. And so you know, and I won't tell you all the details, but right, Israel was commanded to keep the Sabbath. And then you get to Jesus' time, and the Pharisees had created all of these extra rules surrounding the Sabbath. And Jesus actually kind of called them out on it and said, man, like, you know, Jesus' disciples picked grain on the Sabbath. And Jesus said, man, you're missing the point. The Sabbath was created for us, not you for the Sabbath, right? And then you get to certain New Testament passages which talk about the fact that as followers of Jesus, we have Sabbath rest in him. So Colossians 2:16-17 says, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So Paul says in Colossians, the Sabbath, festivals, food, drink, those were all shadows of something that was coming, and that something was Jesus. He is the substance of those things. So then you go back and you go, okay, well, the Sabbath is actually about Jesus. It was pointing forward to a spiritual rest that we can have in him. Hebrews 4:10 says, for whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. Right? So that's referring to Genesis chapter 2. God rested from his work, but the writer of Hebrews says, whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works. So he's talking about followers of Jesus. We actually rest from our works because we're not striving to obey the law in order to achieve salvation. It's like, no, we rest from our striving. So every day is the Sabbath in Christ. Romans 14:5 says, one person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. Kevin said on Facebook, what about doctors and police? Is Jesus the Sabbath? We are to rest in him. Yeah, I would agree with you, Kevin. I think in a couple of places, Paul says, like, if you are convinced that you need to take a Sabbath, he basically says, if you think one day is better than another and your friend thinks every day is the same, be convinced in your own mind. So, like, right, my friend that I said, you know, takes every Sunday off, doesn't work, I don't think he's sinning by doing that. I think that's what Paul says, right? If you're convinced in your mind that's what you need to do, have at it. But I think the New Testament is really clear that we are not bound to be religious about the Sabbath, because ultimately the Sabbath was pointing forward to Jesus, right? And even in Matthew, when Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest, right? The Sabbath rest was pointing forward to Jesus and what he's accomplished for us. So I don't think that Christians are bound to religiously keep the Sabbath. I mean, obviously everyone needs a day off every now and then, but I don't think there's a spiritual, like, yes, I'm obeying Jesus by religiously making sure I do no work on Sunday. I think Jesus would say, maybe you've missed the point of what the Sabbath is. So that's day seven. That's all I had for tonight. Wanted to unpack the rest of day six and day seven. Any last questions or comments? Next week, we're going to get into the rest of chapter two, which, like I said, it's like this expanded look at what happened on the sixth day. It's a closer look at the creation of the first human beings, and God gives us much more detail about what that actually looked like and what it meant. And so I'm excited to dive into the rest of chapter 2. So hopefully, my hope as we've studied this first book, you know, this first chapter, these 7 days of creation, my hope is that you see the beauty of this chapter in the Bible, right? God bringing order to chaos and God setting up functions and then filling those places with living things. And then God bestowing, like, unbelievable dignity and worth and value to human beings, right? People made to be like him and to represent him, to have dominion and to take care of his creation. It really is just a beautiful chapter. So that being said, I think we'll leave it at that. As always, if you have other questions throughout the week, you can always message me. I'm going to put this on our website tomorrow, in the audio form as well. And so hopefully that is helpful to you, and I'll put my notes on there as well. But thanks for tuning in. It was good interacting with some of you, and we will talk to you next week.